Matthew chapter 4, verses 8 through 11. The 11th talk in a series on the Gospel of Matthew was presented by Ron Julian on May 24, 2015 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2015. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved.
Okay, we will look at the third and last of the temptations of Jesus in the wilderness. So we're in the fourth chapter of Matthew, verses 8 through 11. I want to start by repeating what I said last time, my sort of general summary of what is happening in these temptations. Jesus has just been baptized by John the Baptist. He has seen the heavens open. He has seen the Spirit of God descend upon him in a visible form. He has heard a voice declare, "This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased." And yet, after these dazzling supernatural demonstrations that he is indeed the Messiah, Jesus is not led off in triumph. Instead, he is led by the Spirit of God to wander hungry for 40 days in the wilderness. It is this tension that is at the heart of the temptations. On the one hand, Jesus has powerful assurances from God that he, Jesus, is God's beloved Son, is the Messiah. And yet on the other hand, God has led Jesus into great hardship and deprivation. Jesus has been assured by God that he has a glorious destiny. One day he will rule over all the world in peace and righteousness, and yet right now God is asking him to suffer. Jesus knows that God wants him to be in the wilderness going hungry. At the end of the 40 days, Satan comes to tempt him. Satan probably wants to destroy Jesus personally, but more importantly, Satan's purpose would be to disqualify Jesus as the Messiah. He wants to destroy God's plan of salvation by leading the Messiah into sin and faithlessness. And yet, God has deeper, overriding reasons for this encounter between Jesus and Satan. First of all, God is testing Jesus. God wants to show that Jesus is qualified, in fact, to be the Messiah. Second, I think that God has deliberately set up the circumstances to echo the story of Israel's wanderings in the wilderness. Like Israel, Jesus is led by God into the wilderness. Like Israel, Jesus is left to go hungry in the wilderness. Like Israel, Jesus is led by God for a time period that is described as 40. Israel was 40 years in the wilderness. Jesus is 40 days in the wilderness. Like Israel, Jesus is being tested in the wilderness. And like Israel, Jesus has received miraculous assurances from God. Israel was promised that God would lead them to the promised land and had witnessed the parting of the Red Sea and other miracles. Jesus was assured that he indeed was the Messiah and had witnessed the opening of the heavens, the descent of the Spirit, and the voice of God. So, like Israel, Jesus must confront the tension between the great promises from God and the great hardships he is currently facing. Jesus himself shows that he understands this parallel between Israel and himself, I believe, by quoting from a particular sermon of Moses. After Israel had wandered in the wilderness for 40 years, Moses preached a sermon to them. They were about to enter into the promised land, and Moses reminded them of the lessons that they should have learned in the wilderness and what they needed to know as they went into the promised land. And it is this sermon, and only this sermon, that Jesus is quoting from. Jesus understands that Israel faced the same issues that he himself is facing in the wilderness. And why has God deliberately set up Jesus' testing to remind us so strongly of Israel's testing in the wilderness? Well, I think to remind us that Jesus is succeeding where Israel failed. Israel was called to be a blessing to the world and to themselves by being faithful to God. They failed to bless either the world or themselves, but now Jesus, who is, in a kind of a way, the true Israel, is passing the test that they failed. He is the one who will fulfill the hopes of Israel. He is the one who will bring blessing to Israel and to all the world. And of course, another reason God has arranged these events is so that we can learn from Jesus how we should respond to the testing of our faith. Okay, so that's my understanding of the temptations as a whole. We're in Matthew 4, 8 through 11. Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to him, "All these things I will give you if you fall down and worship me." Then Jesus said to him, "Go, Satan, for it is written, 'You shall worship the Lord your God and serve him only.'" Then the devil left him, and behold, angels came and began to minister to him. Okay, so as is true in all three temptations, Jesus quotes from Moses' sermon in Deuteronomy. So before we look at what happens here between Satan and Jesus, this time I'd like to jump right back to Deuteronomy, and let's talk about that first. We're going to be jumping around a little bit in Deuteronomy, but we're starting in chapter 6, verse 1. Deuteronomy 6, 1. "Now, this is the commandment, the statutes, and the judgments which Yahweh your God has commanded me to teach you, that you might do them in the land where you are going over to possess it, so that you and your son and your grandson might fear Yahweh your God, to keep all his statutes and his commandments which I command you all the days of your life, and that your days may be prolonged. O Israel, you should listen and be careful to do it, that it may be well with you and that you may multiply greatly, just as Yahweh, the God of your fathers, has promised you, in a land flowing with milk and honey." Okay, so the focus on the section we're looking at here is on the future. Israel is about to cross over into the land that God had promised their fathers. Remember, this is something that God has been promising for a long time. The Israelites, of course, would like their days to be prolonged. They would like things to go well with them. They would like to multiply greatly. They would like to prosper in this land flowing with milk and honey. This is what they would like. This sounds like a good deal. And that is what God is, in fact, promising them if they will keep Yahweh's statutes and commandments. The previous generation was not allowed to enter into the promised land because they were unfaithful and unbelieving. That's why they wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. Moses is reminding the present generation that they face the same issue as they go into the land. Will they be faithful to Yahweh or not? So this brings us then to one of the most important statements in the Old Testament, a very well-known statement to the Jews, Deuteronomy 6:4. "Hear, O Israel, Yahweh is our God, Yahweh is one. You shall love Yahweh your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might." Okay, so this is a very well-known passage, often referred to with the Hebrew form of that first word here, Shema. You will hear people talk about the Shema, and that's this statement. What does this mean, Yahweh is one? I think it's actually quite relevant to what we're looking at in this section, what Jesus is quoting here. So I'd like to talk about it for just a minute. And I'm going to do that in a way that turns out to be surprising. It surprised me that I'm going to end up talking about it this way. We're going to be taught on this passage by one of the Pharisees in the New Testament. So I want to turn to Mark 12:28. So in Mark 12:28, "One of the scribes came and heard them arguing, and recognizing that Jesus had answered them well, asked him, 'What commandment is the foremost of all?' Jesus answered, 'The foremost is, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. The second is this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these. The scribe said to him, Right, teacher, you have truly stated that he is one and there is no one else besides him. And to love him with all the heart and with all the understanding and with all the strength and to love one's neighbor as himself is much more than all burnt offerings and sacrifices. When Jesus saw that he had answered intelligently, he said to him, You are not far from the kingdom of God. I have always liked this story. This scribe, this teacher, is presumably a Pharisee. And so we see that not all of the people that Jesus encountered were bad guys. Not all the Pharisees were bad guys. And we also see that Jesus was not teaching something new and strange and bizarre. Jesus and the scribe both agree about what the Old Testament is saying. The scribe is pleased to find that Jesus is saying what the scribe himself believes, and Jesus is pleased to see that the scribe has an intelligent understanding of the Old Testament. And since Jesus and the scribe seem to agree, I'm going to rely on something that the scribe said here, because I think he got this right, and it kind of helps us see something. In verse 32, he says, Right, teacher, you have truly stated that he is one, and there is no one else besides him. The scribe is explaining what he sees, I think, as the significance of saying the Lord is one. He restates it as, there is no one else besides him. Yahweh is the one God. Yahweh alone is God. Yahweh is uniquely God. There is no one else besides him. And that, I think, is the significance of the statement in Deuteronomy. I think the scribe has rightly understood that. That is why Moses goes on to tell us to love God with all our heart and all our soul and all our might. If Yahweh were not one, then our hearts could be divided. I could give Yahweh some of my heart, but I could reserve part of it for another God, another important thing. But Yahweh is one. That is, Yahweh alone is God. Yahweh is uniquely God. There is no one else besides him. And so I must love him with all my heart and all my soul and all my strength. There can be nothing left over for any other God or for anything else. So as we'll see, this fits extremely well into the context of what Moses is saying in Deuteronomy. As they go into the land, they are to be faithful to Yahweh alone. Okay, so continuing on in Deuteronomy, we come to 6:6. He says, These words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your sons and shall talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way. And when you lie down, and when you rise up, you shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontals on your forehead. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. And this makes sense, what he's saying here. If it is important that they take Yahweh seriously, important that they obey him and listen to his statutes, then it is important that they constantly remind themselves what it is that Yahweh wants from them. Okay? So we come to Deuteronomy 6:10 now. Then it shall come about, when Yahweh your God brings you into the land which he swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you great and splendid cities which you did not build, and houses full of all good things which you did not fill, and hewn cisterns which you did not dig, vineyards and olive trees which you did not plant, and you eat and are satisfied, then watch yourself, that you do not forget Yahweh who brought you from the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Okay, so Israel is about to enter into the promised land. Once they are settled in, it will be all too easy to forget how they got it. They could forget that the abundance of the land is not something that they worked for and produced. They could forget that they received everything from the hand of Yahweh. Now, one result of forgetting Yahweh might be to think, well, we accomplished this all ourselves. And that is one of the things that Moses warns against, and that would be bad. But he always follows that up with another warning of an even worse result that could come about. If they forget that they have everything from the hand of Yahweh, then they might start thinking that they could depend on other gods as well, the gods of the land. They could forget that Yahweh is one. They could forget that there is no God except Yahweh. They could turn to the gods of the land that they're entering. And that would be the worst thing of all. And that then brings us to the verse that Jesus is quoting, more or less, Deuteronomy 6:13. You shall fear Yahweh your God, and you shall worship him and swear by his name. You shall not follow other gods, any of the gods of the peoples who surround you, for Yahweh your God in the midst of you is a jealous God. Otherwise, the anger of Yahweh your God will be kindled against you, and he will wipe you off the face of the earth. So here we see the language that Jesus is quoting. Here Moses is addressing this fundamental issue: whom are the Israelites going to worship? This topic of worship is actually a central and important one in Deuteronomy. It's how Moses starts his sermon in the very beginning. He starts his sermon by repeating what we call the Ten Commandments that he first gave in Exodus. And this is the first thing that Moses tells them. And how does that start? The Ten Commandments start with, I am Yahweh your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the water under the earth. You shall not worship them or serve them, for I, Yahweh your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and on the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing loving kindness to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. So this is the very first thing that God tells them through this sermon of Moses: you shall have no other gods before me. You shall not worship the idols. You shall not serve the idols. I am a jealous God. If you worship other gods, bad things will come. We see this again in Deuteronomy 8:18, where Moses says, but you shall remember Yahweh your God, for it is he who is giving you power to make wealth, that he may confirm his covenant, which he swore to your fathers, as it is this day. It shall come about, if you ever forget Yahweh your God, and go after other gods, and serve them, and worship them, I testify against you today that you will surely perish. Like the nations that Yahweh makes to perish before you, so you shall perish, because you would not listen to the voice of Yahweh your God. This is just like our passage in Deuteronomy in chapter 6 that we're looking at. Moses says there is this danger that you will go into the land and forget that God is the one who has given you all this abundance, and then you might go after other gods to worship them, and then you will perish. Again, in Deuteronomy 11:16, beware that your hearts are not deceived and that you do not turn away and serve other gods and worship them, or the anger of Yahweh will be kindled against you and he will shut up the heavens so that there will be no rain and the ground will not yield its fruit and you will perish quickly from the good land which Yahweh is giving you. So, don't let your hearts be deceived. You should not turn away and worship other gods, or you will perish. We saw how Moses started his sermon. This is how he ends it. In Deuteronomy 30:15, see, I have set before you today life and prosperity, and death and adversity, in that I command you today to love Yahweh your God, to walk in his ways, and to keep his commandments and his statutes and his judgments, that you may live and multiply, and that Yahweh your God may bless you in the land where you are entering to possess it. But if your heart turns away and you will not obey, but are drawn away and worship other gods and serve them, I declare to you today that you shall surely perish. You will not prolong your days in the land where you are crossing the Jordan to enter and possess it. I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that I have set before you life and death, the blessing and the curse. So choose life in order that you may live, you and your descendants, by loving Yahweh your God, by obeying his voice, and by holding fast to him. For this is your life and the length of your days, that you may live in the land which Yahweh swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give them. So, you face this choice, the blessing or the curse in front of you. The blessing comes if you hold fast to Yahweh. The curse comes if you worship other gods. Moses begins his sermon with this warning. Moses ends his sermon with this warning. Moses sprinkles this warning throughout his sermon, including the one that Jesus quotes. So Jesus could have pretty much chosen any of these passages to quote because they all have a very similar idea. He chose to quote Deuteronomy 6:13, which, let me remind you, says, Deuteronomy 6:13, you shall fear Yahweh your God, and you shall worship him and swear by his name. You shall not follow other gods, any of the gods of the people who surround you, for Yahweh your God in the midst of you is a jealous God. Otherwise, the anger of Yahweh your God will be kindled against you, and he will wipe you off the face of the earth. Okay, so I say that Jesus quoted Deuteronomy 6:13. In a way, we might say that Jesus has actually quoted all of those passages, because he has not quoted Deuteronomy 6:13 precisely as it reads. It seems pretty clear that that's the passage he means, but he actually has expressed it in such a way that it's kind of more like a summary quotation that captures the essence of all these warnings to worship only God. So the message of Deuteronomy that Jesus is getting across by quoting this is, you shall worship Yahweh alone, you shall not worship other gods, your destiny depends on it. Well, many years ago, when I first encountered these ideas, this is very familiar, you're not supposed to worship other gods, and you pick that up pretty quickly once you become familiar with the Bible at all. But I didn't quite know how to take that seriously. Obviously, it was a bad thing, but it wasn't clear to me what exactly is going on. In particular, I kept thinking, how hard is it to avoid worshiping other gods? Why that? I look around me and I see people who very easily manage to keep their religion their whole life. They never switch to another religion. They just keep it. And what they said they believed when they were younger, they believe when they're older, and they just do it. Is that so hard? Why is that so hard? Why would Israel want to worship other gods anyway? What's the advantage to it? My problem was that I thought of worship as primarily involving religious ritual. We gather together and sing, God is great, and that's worship. So as an Israelite, all you have to do is make sure that you only sing songs that say, Yahweh is great. Don't sing any songs that say, Baal is great. How hard could that be? Just don't sing those songs. Sing the songs about Yahweh. Don't sing about Baal. Well, my problem was that I had too trivial a view of what worship is. The word worship has the basic meaning to bow down before, to prostrate oneself before, to lower oneself before someone. It is the sort of thing that you do before a king or a ruler. By physically lowering yourself, you are communicating your understanding of your relationship to the king. The king is your superior. He is more important than you are. And very importantly, you are dependent on the king. You need the king to take care of you. and you are communicating your dependence by doing homage to him, lowering yourself, worshiping him. This is particularly relevant in your relationship with a God, because this is what it means to have a God. For instance, God says to Israel, "I will be your God, and you will be my people." To say that Yahweh will be Israel's God is to say that Yahweh is superior to them, more important than they are, but very importantly, that they are dependent on Yahweh. They need Yahweh's goodwill. To say that Israel will be Yahweh's people is to say Yahweh is committing himself to take care of them. They are right to look to him for help because he is willing to help them. He is going to be their God, the one that they depend on. And so, it is important for Israel to worship Yahweh. That is, they must, in their hearts, bow the knee to Yahweh. They must acknowledge that he is their superior. They must acknowledge that he is their provider, that they are dependent on him. Furthermore, they must acknowledge that only Yahweh is their God. There is no one else to whom they will bow the knee. There is no one else who can take care of them. Yahweh alone is the source of life. If Yahweh does not help them, then no one will. That's what's at stake when we talk about worshiping Yahweh and him alone. Now the issue starts to come into focus. To worship another God is to say to that God, "You are my superior. You are one who can take care of me. I will serve you if you will take care of me." The Israelites did not necessarily abandon Yahweh altogether. They still included him in their list of gods. But when difficult times would come, they would forget who Yahweh was. They thought to themselves, "We need someone to take care of us, and Yahweh doesn't seem to be doing anything at the moment. Things are looking a little lean, and where's Yahweh? So maybe Baal is the guy that we should be talking to here. We are willing to look to any God who can take care of us." Well, Yahweh is saying through Moses, "I am the only true source of what you need. If you acknowledge that, if you bow to me alone, I will take care of you. But if you believe the lie that there is some other God who can take care of you better, then I will cut you off." So that's what I understand to be at stake in the thing that Jesus is quoting. Let's go back again to Matthew chapter 4, verses 8 through 11. Let me read that again. It's short. "Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to him, 'All these things I will give you if you fall down and worship me.' Then Jesus said to him, 'Go, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God and serve him only.' Then the devil left him, and behold, angels came and began to minister to him." Okay, so it seems to me that in general, what is at stake in this story is fairly clear. We don't have as much explanation of the details as we might like. To just mention a few, how exactly did Satan take Jesus to the top of a mountain? What exactly is it that happened there? Is this a visionary experience? Is it an actual moving from one place to another? What exactly is it that Satan showed him? What was he looking at? I don't know the answers to these questions. I don't have a strong opinion about the various options that I can think of for how to put that stuff together. What does make sense to me is this. Satan is offering Jesus the ruling authority over the kingdoms of the world. It says that he is showing Jesus all the kingdoms of the world, and we need to understand that's not just an archaic way of saying countries or something like that. Kingdoms are places that are ruled by kings. Kingdoms are places where someone has dominion and authority over the people. It says that he is showing Jesus their glory. This is the glory and honor that comes to the one who has a kingdom, who rules. In the version of this story that we find in Luke, we're looking in Matthew, but in the corresponding story in Luke, Satan says he will give Jesus authority or dominion. The issue here is rule, is kingship. And that being the case, we can see that Satan is offering Jesus the same thing that God has promised Jesus. God has proclaimed Jesus to be his beloved son. That is, he is the Messiah. And dominion over the kingdoms of the world is exactly what the Messiah will inherit. We see this exact language in the visions of Daniel. In chapter 7 of Daniel, a very important messianic passage, there is a vision of one like a son of man, a human being, who comes up to the throne of God. And this, pretty much everyone agrees, is meant to be a picture of the Messiah. Daniel describes the glorious destiny of this man, the Messiah, in Daniel 7:14. And to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom, that all the peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. And this passage is using exactly the same set of concepts that we see Satan talking about with Jesus: dominion or authority, glory, and a kingdom. Later in the chapter, the Messiah and his people are said to receive the sovereignty and the dominion and the greatness of all the kingdoms under the whole heaven. The Messiah is going to rule over a great and glorious kingdom that has dominion over all the kingdoms of the world. That is the inheritance that Jesus has as the Messiah. That is the expectation of what the Messiah's role will be, as according to Daniel in the Old Testament. And that's exactly what Satan is showing Jesus on that mountain. The kingdoms of the world, their glory and dominion or authority over them. Satan is offering Jesus the rule and authority that is Jesus' birthright. So we might ask at this point, is Satan telling the truth? Could he even do such a thing? Does he have authority over the kingdoms of the world? In the Gospel of Luke, Satan says, "I will give you all this dominion and its glory, for it has been handed over to me, and I give it to whomever I wish." Is he telling the truth about that? Well, it seems to me the only way that I can make sense of it is that he's kind of telling a half-truth. Satan does have a kind of authority over this world. Several times in the Gospel of John, Jesus calls Satan the ruler of this world. Paul refers to Satan as the god of this world. Satan has been given at least a limited authority to deceive the nations. But this is limited. He can only deceive those whom God allows to be deceived, and Satan has power only as long as God allows it. So he could never really fulfill this promise ultimately to give Jesus the eternal, glorious rule over all creation that God has promised. He doesn't have that much power. He doesn't have that much authority. So why would Jesus even be tempted to listen to him? Once again, I think, at least this is what makes sense to me, it comes back to Jesus' situation in the wilderness, as all three of the temptations have. Yes, around 40 days ago, the voice of God declared Jesus to be the beloved Son of God. Heavens opened, Spirit descending, big, big deal. But a lot of hard days have happened since then. God has made it clear that Jesus will have to travel a very hard road before he inherits his crown. Jesus is starving and depleted, and while Jesus is in this weak and emaciated state, Satan gives him a vision of glory in some way. He says to him, "You could have that authority and glory now, right now. Let's skip the suffering that God clearly has in store for you. Right now, you can hardly stand up, but in a moment, you could have the world at your feet." And what does Satan want Jesus to do to receive all this authority? He wants him to fall down and worship him. Well, in the light of what we were looking at in Deuteronomy and what I understand the issue to be in worship, this is what right now I would understand Satan to be saying. This is what he's getting at. Jesus, I have what you want. I can give you the glory that is your destiny, and you can have it without the kinds of sufferings you are going through right now. I am the one to come to. I am the source of what you want. What I want from you, Jesus, is that you acknowledge this. I want you to prostrate yourself before me. I want you to acknowledge that I have been given authority over the world. I want you to acknowledge that I am the only source of glory that is free from suffering. Nobody else is going to make you this deal. You're going to have to come to me. I am not necessarily asking you to totally deny God. I admit, God's still a big guy, but right now, I'm in charge here. I mean, who put me in charge anyway? I'm the guy in charge. I have authority over this world, and I can give that authority to whom I wish. And my motto is, less suffering, more glory. So I want you to acknowledge that I am the only one who can give you this easy road to glory. I want you to submit yourself to me and say, you are the one who can give me what I need, and then I will give it to you. It's kind of like the opening scene of The Godfather. Buonasera comes to Don Corleone seeking his help. He wants the Don to help him take revenge on those who have harmed his daughter, if I remember correctly. But Don Corleone won't help Buonasera until he shows the Don some respect. He says, you've never come to talk to me before. You've never invited me out for coffee or anything. Now you need something and you come to me. He wants Buonasera to call him Godfather. By saying this, Buonasera acknowledges himself to be needy and dependent on Don Corleone. The Godfather is his superior. The Godfather is the one who gives him what he wants, the only one who can give him what he's looking for. And so, in essence, he's being asked to worship him. That is, he must metaphorically bow the knee to Don Corleone by calling him Godfather. That is how I am understanding Satan's temptation here. He says to Jesus, I am ready and willing to give you the easy road to glory. I just want you to call me Godfather. And at this point, Jesus tells Satan to go away. And he quotes Deuteronomy 6:13, the essence of which is, only God is to be worshipped. There is only one source of what I need. There's only one to whom I will bow the knee. God is one, and there is no one else besides him. Jesus truly believes that God will indeed give him his inheritance. Jesus will be the Messiah, the ruler over all the earth. But if God wants him to achieve that throne through suffering, then that is what Jesus will do. Jesus will not turn to Satan or anyone else who promises an easier road. God alone is God. God alone is the source of every good thing. Satan can do nothing for Jesus. After Satan leaves, angels of God come to minister to Jesus, presumably with food and bodily care and comfort and so on, after this extended time of hardship in the wilderness. Okay, so let me just make a few last comments here then. The three temptations of Jesus confront us with the relationship between the past, the present, and the future. We look to the past and we find good reason to put our trust in God. We look to the future and remember the promises that God has made, the hope that he has given us. But now, in the present, we wrestle with the fact that we suffer. We feel sometimes that something is missing. We struggle with our feeling that we don't yet have what we need. And in the face of this lack, we have to decide what we are going to do with God. Jesus quoted from Moses' sermon three times, and from my perspective, each time Moses is describing what it means to be faithful in the face of the present lack, but he's just doing it from slightly different angles. It's basically the same point each time, it's just a little bit different. Each time Moses is telling us how to face into the hardships of today, the difficult present, by remembering God's faithfulness in the past and by remembering God's promises for the future. And so, in that way, we will persevere in being people of faith. Moses just comes at this from three different directions. So let me paraphrase, just a reminder of what I think those three different directions are. First of all, Moses says something like this. When we are lacking and needy in the present, we are tempted to think that if we only had this lack taken care of now, then we would be okay. If we only had the bread in hand now, we could thrive. But remember the faithfulness of God in the past and the promises of God for the future. We don't find life because we have everything in hand right now. We are not in good shape because we've got everything we need right now. We will find life because we are depending on God, who is the source of life. If he leads me into a wilderness without bread, I should still follow him there, because he alone is the true source of life. Next, Moses, in essence, says something like this. When we are lacking and needy in the present, we are tempted to think that God has to prove himself to us. We are tempted to withhold our trust until God comes through with what we think we need. But remember the faithfulness of God in the past and the promises of God for the future. God has nothing to prove to us. We have every reason to trust him. In fact, we know that God cares very much that we learn this lesson. He sometimes takes us through the wilderness precisely so we can learn to trust him there. Finally, Moses, in essence, says this. When we are lacking and needy in the present, we are tempted to turn to someone or something that we think is better and more reliable than God. We think we need another God. We think we need someone or something else to give us what we think we need. But remember the faithfulness of God in the past and the promises of God for the future. There is no one else to turn to, and we have every reason to stick with God and God alone. God has shown himself faithful, and he always keeps his promises. So these are the three lessons that Israel failed to learn. Individual Israelites along the way learned these lessons, of course. But Israel as a nation was faithless in the wilderness, and Israel as a nation was faithless in the promised land. They could not see beyond their present circumstances to embrace the promises of God. But where Israel failed, Jesus succeeded. Jesus triumphantly embraced and lived out these three lessons from Moses. I think it's a powerful story. It has become a powerful story to me, especially this time as I've been looking at it. Jesus, the King of the world, is called to take the path of faithful suffering on his way to the throne of David. And he is gloriously faithful in every way. By this, he shows how truly fitting it was for him to be the Messiah. And as I've said, I think God means this story to be a kind of parable, an enactment of the relationship between Jesus and Israel. Jesus and Israel were both led by God into the wilderness. There, Jesus lived out the lessons that Israel failed to learn. Jesus is the true son of Israel who brings their hopes to fruition. And then, finally, of course, you and I must learn these same lessons. We are in exactly the same situation, caught in the tension between past, present, and future. Our situation is like Israel in the wilderness. In Israel's past was the 10 miraculous plagues, the parting of the Red Sea, the manna, and much more. They had every reason to believe that God was on their side. In Israel's future was the land and blessing promised by God. But at present, they were marching through the wilderness, facing lack of food, lack of water, fierce enemies, and so on. Our situation is like Jesus in the wilderness. In Jesus' past was the parting of the heavens, the descent of the Spirit, the voice of God proclaiming him as God's beloved Son. He had every reason to believe that God was on his side. In Jesus' future was the messianic throne of David, where he would rule in righteousness and peace over all creation. But at present, he was wandering in the wilderness. God was requiring him to go without food, to suffer hardship, to be tested. Our situation is the same. In our past are all the reasons we have to trust God. The testimony of God through his creation, the testimony of God through his scriptures, the testimony of God through our individual life experience. In our future are the magnificent promises of eternal life in the kingdom of God. But at present, we are wandering in the wilderness. God has us there so that we might learn the most important lessons of all. We are learning that God is the source of life. We are learning to stop demanding that God prove himself to us. We are learning that there is no other God to turn to. God has promised us the life that we truly need. There is nothing or no one in this world that can give us life if God does not. God is one, and there is no one else besides him. Okay, so any questions or comments you might have?
There's something a little more insidious going on in The Last Temptation, because it seems like one way of looking at it is Satan comes to Jesus and says, you have suffering in your future that you'll need to go through, but here I am to give you these benefits now so you can avoid that. But I wonder if another kind of trickier thing that might be going on is Satan saying, look, you've already been through your suffering. Look back on being hungry and tired. You've completed the suffering you need to do as Messiah. So now it's time for you to take what I'm giving you. So any thoughts on that? Because it seems like that would be a more compelling sort of argument and harder to say, well, no, that's not right. If the message is you're doing everything you need to do as Messiah, now do this next thing.
Okay, so the way you explained it the second time makes me think that I didn't understand what you said the first time. So could you try again?
I'll try.
Okay.
It seems like one way to take the last temptation here is Satan's coming to Jesus, and Jesus has an understanding that as Messiah, he has suffering he will need to go through, that he'll continue to be abased and suffer and be humiliated before he is glorified. And so what Satan could be saying on the one hand is, here's how you avoid all of that by taking what I'm offering you now. But what if the message is instead Satan saying, look, you've already been through the suffering and abasement by being in the wilderness for 40 days. Now it's right for you to take the glory that I'm offering. Does that distinction make sense?
Yeah, I don't know. Okay, so tell me why. My initial reaction is that, yes, I can see the distinction you're making. It's not I'm giving you a bypass to the suffering that you may still face, but congratulations, you passed the test. Now here's your reward. It's over. Why would I pick that one over the other one?
I guess I'm asking that also. I'm trying to puzzle okay. out what could be going on.
Yeah.
Because it would raise the question of, it's not that what Satan's offering is in and of itself not fit for Jesus. It's that it's the wrong time for it, just like it could have been the wrong time for him to turn the stones into bread. So I'm still puzzled, and I'm not really sure where to go with that.
Okay. Yeah, the wrong time, yes, from the wrong hand as well.
Okay, so you see it as a question of who is offering.
Yeah, my understanding of that is saying, you worship me and I will give you this, is that for Jesus to look at the situation and say, yeah, it is you are the one who from whom I can get this thing. And that's why it seems to me that it includes the idea that it is a bypassing suffering, because Satan can't say, well, there's no possible way that you're going to get this from God. But what he can say and imply is, it may be a while and it may be a hard road. I can give it to you right now. So that's why you should take it from me instead of waiting and take it from him. So that's kind of the way I would lean. It has not occurred to me. What you're suggesting hasn't occurred to me, so I'd have to think about it to see if there's more merit to it than what I'm seeing right now. But I don't know if my answer makes sense, but that's why I would lean that way.
Thank you.
It seems like in each of these temptations, and especially looking back at the experience of the Israelites in Deuteronomy, that a huge factor in what's going on in both of those situations is the question of, does God have the right to do what he's doing as God? And the first temptation with the bread, clearly God's put Jesus in this situation. Jesus is submitting to that, but he's on the verge of starvation. And so part of, I think, what seems to be behind what Satan is positing to Jesus is, you're about to die. Does God have the right to kill you? Are you really willing to submit to God even if he decides that he's not going to come through and give you some food here? And Jesus' answer is, I'm submitting myself to the will of the Father. I think implied in that is, even if he doesn't choose to sustain me, it's not my call to deliver myself from this situation. Obviously, Jesus knows the character of God, and I think knowing his own destiny, that, you know, he's trusting that God's going to carry him through. In the second temptation, it seems like, similarly to the Israelites, God asks a tremendous amount of faith on the part of the Israelites and on the part of Jesus. It's not that he hasn't demonstrated himself to be a good God and to care for them, but our human temptation is that as soon as life gets tough, we start to wonder, I mean, is God really on my side? You're not doing things the way that I would want things to be done. So I'm going to put you to the test. You don't have the right to be God unless you demonstrate to me that you're going to give me what I want, that you're going to act and operate in a way that's consonant with how I think life should go. And in a similar way, Jesus's temptation to throw himself off is Satan saying, hey, look at the suffering that you're going through. Does God have the right to put you to this test? Does God have the right to put you in this situation? Or why don't you put God to the test and make him show that he's the sort of God who is worthy of doing this sort of thing to you? And with the last temptation, it seems like it's a similar question. God's given you this promise, this destiny. You know, does he have the right to put you through the suffering that's ahead of you to get there? Are you going to trust him that this road that's going to lead to your death is the road that is right for you to walk before you get that honor and that glory? Why don't you take my offer? It's the same in the end. It's honor and glory and dominion. Are you really willing to say that God has the right to put you through what you're going to go through before you get there? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, what you're proposing as an option is very clear, and it's not the direction that I have gone. That if I can, and let me describe the distinction as I understand it. Maybe I'm not capturing the distinction, but I think I understood what you were saying. Let me describe two things that I should rightly think about in my relationship with God. Number one, God has the right to deal with me as his creature as he wishes, even if I die, even if it does not lead to my benefit. Number two, God has made promises to me that he will do this good thing for me, and I should continue to trust that he will do this good thing for me, even though he is taking me through difficulties now. So those are related sorts of issues, but they're not the same issue, as I would see it. One of them is God's right to do whatever he wants, no matter what the outcome is for me, because I'm acknowledging that God, in his wisdom, is right to do what he does. But the other is looking at God's promise and saying, in spite of where he has me now, I believe that he is going to do what he said. And the way I am taking the temptations is that second direction. But it is quite possible to go, I haven't talked a lot about how Jack takes this stuff, but I know that the way Jack takes the first temptation is more along the lines of what you are saying than what I am saying. So there's an argument that could be made on both sides, but I'm right now pretty firmly on the side of trusting in the faithfulness of God in the midst of circumstances that force me to ask, am I going to trust him or not? So I think I understand the distinction you're making, and it is a good point, and it is something that we need to come to terms with. I'm not seeing it as the issue in the temptations.
And I don't think, I think that it's, that what you're saying is the other option is pretty closely aligned with what I think is going on in third, because clearly Jesus knows that that glory and that destiny is his should he continue to submit to the will of the Father. But the road to get there is going to be hard.
Right.
And is, I think part of his choice is, am I really going to believe that this is the right way to get there? This is the best way to get there, and that I'm going to submit to that. Right. And I think closely tied in with the struggle that he has in the garden.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to Toby now, because he's had his hand up for quite a while.
I like that these verses really emphasize Jesus' physicality, his weakness as a human, his weakness as a mortal, as they would say. For these to be viable, as a part of me as a 6-year-old when I heard the story, it was kind of like, you know, that's a no-brainer. A guy shows up who's wearing horns painted in red in the middle of the desert. You don't do anything he says. For these temptations to be real temptations, don't they also have to be intellectual or based on identity or psychological? Like, don't they have to be calling into questions Jesus' understanding of himself? It seems like somebody who knew the whole story, if God has like omniscient God vision, it's an easy one to punt on. I mean, like, come on, he's got red horns, he's in the desert, he's offering you nice things, just don't take the nice things. Like, the physicality aside, obviously he's weak, obviously he's thirsty, obviously he's hungry, obviously he racked from all the things that a human being is racked from. These are hard things to overcome. And I really enjoyed your parallel between them, these temptations, and what the Israelites experienced in the desert. I found that very powerful. Aren't these also coming on the heels of Jesus's beginning to understand what kind of a deal he is? And isn't the arc, it feels like the arc of his story must be a little murky to him. He doesn't know how this story is going to go. Yes, he's been promised these things in the same way that Abraham was promised great things. In the first place Abraham goes, there's a famine. And so it feels like that great, beautiful pageant that God brings before each believer, where he says, you're going to be here one day, and obviously almost the first step is in the opposite direction. Like, so don't these things have to be also ideological in nature for Jesus? Don't they have to call into question what he actually might really be or might not be? Do you get a sense that he's like, well, I'm the Messiah, so I'm going to pass this test? But isn't there part of the doubt that comes about? Must there also be uncertainty in who Jesus believes he himself might be? Isn't the temptations only powerful if Jesus is kind of like, I think I'm this dude. I'm reading the scripture and I think I'm this dude. The heavens parted and I think I'm this dude.
Okay, maybe I'm not quite understanding your point. My initial thought when you say that is, the first two temptations, Satan prefaces with, if you're the Son of God, then wouldn't it make sense for you to do this?
Sure.
And my understanding is not, it's not an if as in, I doubt that you are the Son of God, you should doubt it too, but rather more like, since you are the Son of God, then let's do this. So his very temptation is based on kind of the, well, you know, yeah, I agree with you. You're the Messiah. All the more reason why you shouldn't, well, it's not a matter of tricks, but I would say more like, all the more reason why you shouldn't be in a position like this. All the more reason why you should expect that God is going to, you jump off the temple, you should expect that he's going to catch you and those sorts of things.
So appealing to Jesus' hubris then?
No. So it depends on which one we're talking about.
Sure.
I mean, if we're, the way I understand the issue in the jumping off the temple, his response is, you shall not put God to the test. And I argued that if you go back and look in Deuteronomy and what Moses is talking about, putting God to the test is withholding your trust in him until he comes through, until he has demonstrated to you that he is worthy of that trust. Hmm. So I'm seeing the temptation there to look at the present difficult circumstances as giving Jesus the right to call into question God's handling of him. And by jumping off the temple, what he is, would be doing, in essence, is forcing God's hands. I'm going to demand that you demonstrate to me what you don't seem to be demonstrating at the moment, which is that you're on my side, because you're going to catch me. It's that demanding of God that he prove himself. Not that he can do tricks, but prove that he is worthy of my hanging in there with him.
Okay.
So I'm a little lost. I'm not sure where I am in relation to your question at this point.
Okay.
Well, you don't have to stop. I mean, you...
It was just the idea that is Satan tempting Jesus' own belief in himself in some capacity, like own self-importance or something? Like, because it just feels like if it was just about the flesh, it would be a really kind of easy thing to punt and to take care of. And it just, I want to know what psychological work these questions are doing on Jesus with respect to his understanding of historical importance or his understanding of like who Jesus has chosen to be. Like, and so I think you answered it at the very end, this idea that the throwing down of the temple, Jesus would be proving something for himself, though, right? I mean, the temptations have to be something, not just an easing of suffering, but something about a question that would exist in Jesus' mind. I feel like the biggest temptations are psychological in nature, are about testing that faith, the faith element, how we believe in God, and the temptations must be trying to take away from that belief in some ways. I don't know if I've articulated it very well.
Well, I don't know ultimately if we would see the what's at stake in each of the temptations exactly the same way. But when I bring in the physicality, his sufferings, all I mean to suggest is I think it enters into the dynamic of what he is wrestling with, especially in the third one. Well, in each of them in a way. But it's not just the first one, you know, turn the stone to bread. It's not just, wow, I feel really bad, I'd like some bread. It's not just a physical sort of, your body's telling you to eat some bread, you'd better do it. There is this question there of, what is the significance? What does it mean that I am in a situation that God wants me to be in, has put me in, and he has not given me the thing that I need to thrive? If I don't get it, ultimately I'm going to die. And what he's facing into the question of is, what does this mean about my relationship with this God? So, psychological element, it's, yeah, what am I going to do with this? How am I going to, but in each case it's, I think what's central is, how am I going to relate to this God who has put me in this situation? All three of them are about, how am I going to relate to this God, I think.
Thank you. That was kind of the answer I was trying to figure out.
I think your point that Jesus' response by quoting scripture tells us where his head was at. So that should frame our reference. I think that's really important. What I keep reading here is it's almost like they're on two different levels. They're talking about two different things, because I would think, and this could be terrible hubris, but if I was Jesus and he said, hey, throw yourself off the cliff here, and Jesus would say, and I invent what, naked base jumping? I mean, what would be the point? I think he's saying, well, if you're the Son of God, i.e. you are the King of Israel, then he has to put you on the throne. And so anything you do to screw that up between now and then, he'll prevent you from doing. In fact, you don't even have to obey gravity. And Jesus' response is, that's just not who I am. That would be a really wrong kind of person to be. There's no point to throwing myself off there. And there's no point to having this giddy, self-indulgent, spoiled child attitude that I'm the king. I don't have to do what other people do. In the last temptation, to me, I would think that if he said, oh, look, here's the glory of Rome and here's Alexandria, and I would say, yeah, I see a bunch of dark, evil, broken people. I see slavery. I see poverty. I see violence. I see nothing but temporal ambition. Where's the glory in that? I don't want that. See, the long game for Jesus is something the devil hasn't even offered him, and that's eternal kingship over an eternal kingdom that's really beautiful. What he's offering him is, look, call me Godfather, and I'll give you this store, but you have to sign it over to me. Well, where's the authority over the kingdoms of the earth if you're bowing down to someone you call your superior? There's no authority at all in that. You're just simply saying, I'm a satrap. Oh, I get it. I sign the checks and I carry the keys, but you own the place because you own me. See, I find that very confusing. So it almost sounds like Jesus has taken the long view, and Satan may not even have a grip on who he really is in the long view. So he keeps offering him these temporal, earthly tidbits in exchange for not being a king at all, but being a satrap. So it's confusing to me.
Okay, I don't have a lot of time to explore that. What you said is very interesting, but actually the way you started, the thing that you said was good about what I said, is part of the reason why I'm not leaning entirely in the direction that you're talking about, because I'm taking my cues from his answer, which was, you shall not put God to the test for the second one, and you shall worship God only and serve him. So I'm taking my understanding of the nature of what he's confronted with and how he's responding to it. His response seems to me at the heart of what the nature of the temptation was. So, and I'm seeing the way I explained it as being a little more related to those things than the way you did. But I mean, what you said was interesting. It was good. I'm just a little inclined in the other direction, I think. Okay, so we should probably stop.